Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namāsāmi. For the last 3 weeks, I've been in a solitary retreat, enjoying my own company and delighting in the quietness and the flexibility of just being able to follow my own routine. But today I had a few things I had to attend to. One of them was a meeting for about 3 hours this morning, and then this afternoon I had to go into London for a little meeting at Lambeth Palace. And standing on the platform at the, in the tube station, the London Underground, at it was Embankment Station, and this young man came up to me and asked me what kind of a Buddhist I was. So I said, yeah, originally from Thailand, and we got talking, and turned out he had grown up in Edinburgh and had visited Harnham Monastery a few times when he was younger, and had stayed there for a few days. And he was asking, and then he asked me the question, is it more difficult to meditate when you're on the underground? Is it more difficult to meditate on the tube? And so I thought, having spent 3 weeks just with the four walls of my kuti and my mind, I thought about it for a moment and then said, not really. Because if we're practicing in a skillful way, then the mind simply receives the different environments that portrayed by our senses, what we see, hear, smell, taste, and touch. These arise and pass away, and whether it happens to be the four walls of a kuti day after day, or if it happens to be the London Underground, it's really not substantially different in any real or fundamental way. And I feel this is a very important principle. It was a principle that those of us who've practiced under the guidance of Lumpo Samedo will have heard him speak about, and you see over and over again in his teachings, his books, his Dhamma talks. Over and over again, he speaks about the quality of citta viveka, or internal seclusion. Akaya viveka means physical seclusion, so like being on solitary retreat or being, in a community retreat time. Tomorrow evening we'll begin our week of group formal practice to finish the rains retreat. Yeah, these are examples of kaya viveka, physical seclusion. Kaya means the body, viveka means retreat or seclusion. So those qualities of life, the way that we choose to arrange our days, retreat time, the retreats we have at the retreat center, or monastic retreats as a group or individually, these have a very important and powerful role to play in our lives. Otherwise, we wouldn't do it. You know, there's a practical, useful outcome of living in those ways, creating the environment for physical seclusion. But if our peace depends upon having no routine, or our peace depends upon having, say, a group meditation practice where everyone's committing to a quality of restraint, everyone's following a rhythm of sitting and walking meditation through the day, everyone is, say, committing to a standard of noble silence. If our peace depends upon those physical conditions, then it's a very fragile peace. And the example I like to give, or how I like to think of these times of kaya viveka, or situations of physical retreat, personal retreat, it's like if you're learning a musical instrument, then you go to a quiet place, you go to a music room, a little enclosed space where there's no external noise, it's just you and the instrument and the music for you to practice. It's very contained, it's very sterile, it's extremely simple, and it's very deliberately excluding everything else from that particular task of learning the music, developing the skills, teaching your hands and your breath and the body to learn the instrument, learn the music, to be able to repeat those patterns over and over and over again, teaching the fingers where to go, teaching the voice how to move, teaching the body how to breathe, and to work the instrument so that a beautiful, harmonious music can be produced. But anyone who's learned a musical instrument or studied music, you know that you're not learning the instrument just to sit in a music room and repeat the scales over and over and over again. That's not the point. You use that very contained, sterile, and ultra-simple environment in order to develop the skill, so then the skill can be used in a more active way, in a more broad and live situation, so that you can play more music, you can play in front of other people, you can create music of your own. It teaches you how to master the instrument. So kaya viveka, physical seclusion, retreat, is for exactly that same kind of chemistry. It's to help us master the instrument of our own life, to master this mind, this body, to simplify things in as complete and full way. To say, like living on retreat for 3 weeks, and I also like to fast so that I'm not even eating, to make it even simpler. So I didn't even have to come over to the sala and see other humans. It's just living in the most simple way possible. Then I enjoy that. I delight in that kind of simplicity. But the point is not to be, say, creating a peace that is then dependent solely upon that simplicity. It's more using that environment to develop particular skills. And then, because that environment is the most ideal, it's the most supportive for those skills to be cultivated. And then once they're cultivated, once they're developed, then you can take them out into the world. You can, use them in the ways that you interact with other people, with social situations, with times of taking responsibility, at times of supporting others, times of interacting with the schedules and demands of life in the family, in our work, in our relationships with other people and the world around us. So the kaya viveka then supports what we call chitta viveka. And this is the name of Chithurst Monastery. It's not a coincidence. And many of you will know that the reason why Lumpur Samedo chose that name so many years ago, back in 1979, when the monastery first opened, was because he saw that this is an extraordinarily useful mental ability, the quality of chitta viveka is very, very helpful. It is an attitude or a mental skill that is extremely valuable for us. So the times of kaya viveka retreat, either as a group or as an individual, one of its most powerful benefits is to help us develop the skills we need for chitta viveka. So that means chitta viveka is internal seclusion or mental seclusion. So whereas kaya viveka helps you to be in a sort of physically quiet spot while the world is being busy all around you, and so you're making your room or your kuti or your monastery extra quiet, you're making the retreat center extra quiet, you're creating a little zone of sanctuary and stillness in the midst of a whirling world. You can spell the world WORLD, or you can spell it WHIRLED. So, world, like whirling around, that which is whirling, and you can think of it that way too. So we can the retreat situation, we create a little zone of stillness, a zone of sanctuary, a zone of silence in the midst of noise. So that is creating that physical viveka. But with one of the skills that we learn then within that is chitta viveka. So that's how to establish that same kind of stillness within our own heart, not just in the routine or in the group of people, but rather you're creating that zone of stillness, that zone of sanctuary and silence within your own being, within your own heart. So there's a sense of watching, of observing, of attending whilst the world does its thing around you. So in a way, it's bringing that quality of stillness and quietness rather than the living environment outside to the internal environment. So chitta viveka is that, if you like, inner spaciousness. So you're standing on the tube, surrounded by people, rattling along through the London Underground, but you can still have a sense of great quietness, great stillness, even as the noise and the people and the smells and the colours and the whole physicality, the impact of the sense world is rattling around through eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, but it can all be known within a great spaciousness. There can be the mind attending to the quality of stillness, the silence behind and between the sounds, the silence that permeates the sound, the space that is between the forms, the spaces between people, the spaces within, the space that permeates all forms, the stillness that is permeating all movement, the stillness within which all movement happens. So chitta viveka is that quality of attending to these aspects of minds, in a sense knowing that the world is happening in your mind, so that there is a recognition of, yes, here we are, Amravati. We're not on the tube, we're in the Amravati temple, but we're hearing, we're feeling, we're seeing. There's the sense world arising and passing, but seeing and hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, these are all patterns of consciousness arising and passing away. And there's a knowing, there's a watching, there's an attending. And when the heart, as say, abides in that quality of knowing, of watching, of seeing, then there can be a great variety of noise, all the words I'm saying, the sounds that I'm making, the colors. We got the lights up this evening so that the people making this documentary can actually record some stuff on their cameras. rather than mood, the sort of soft mood lighting of the temple as it normally is during a Dhamma talk. So color, sound, meaning of the words, but yet all of that color and form and change, if we're not fixated on that and judging that, liking, disliking, but rather there's an attending, then there's a spaciousness, there's a stillness. Along with the sound, there's an ability to attend to the silence within which that sound is occurring, along with the forms, the shapes of the people, of the pillars, of the shrine, the Buddha image with its new coating of gold just being applied. That there is between and behind the forms, there is spaciousness. Between the behind, within the sounds, there is silence. Within the movement, there is stillness. There is that which is, beyond coming and going. That which is perfectly still, spacious, silent. So citta viveka is that sense of inner recollection, attending, and knowing that the world arises within the mind. There's a very significant teaching. Bhikkhu Bodhi, a very wonderful Buddhist scholar, translator, and practitioner, made the comment that from his perspective, this particular teaching is perhaps the most profound utterance in the history of human philosophy. And that's where the Buddha, in the teaching to Rohitasa, the Buddha says, you cannot, and Rohitasa was a deva who'd been in a previous lifetime, been a yogi who'd tried to travel to the end of the world and had journeyed endlessly, trying to reach the end of the world, flying through the sky and never being able to make it. Told this story to the Buddha that when he'd been a yogi, he'd tried to reach the world's end. And the Buddha said, it's impossible, Rohitasa, for any being to reach the end of the world by walking. But I tell you also that unless you reach the end of the world, then you won't reach the end of dukkha. You won't reach the end of dissatisfaction. You won't reach the end of suffering. Which is a bit of a conundrum. It's a puzzle, isn't it? You can't reach the end of the world by walking. But if you don't reach the end of the world, then you won't reach the end of the spiritual path. But then, of course, the Buddha goes on to explain. He said, it's in this very life, in this fathom-long body, this 2-meter-long body, or 1.80 meters, whatever it is, this fathom-long body, with its perceptions and its thoughts, there is the origin of the world, there is the world, the origin of the world, the cessation of the world, and the way leading to the cessation of the world. In this very body, with its perceptions, its thoughts. And so in that expression, then he equates the loka, the world, with dukkha, with suffering, with dissatisfaction. He said, this is the world, the world as we know it. And when we see that, we might be a bit puzzled. Well, why does he equate the world with suffering? Because our normal way of thinking, the world is like the planet or the sun and the moon and the stars. What's so wrong with that? Why would we call that dukkha? Why would we call that unsatisfactory? But what he's doing, as far as I understand it, is saying that when we make the world as some separate permanent thing, when we make the world that thing that's solid and real and out there, as soon as that the world loka is given that attribute, as the mind gives the world the attribute, the quality of permanence, of solidity, of something real and other and permanent, then the mind is created dukkha. It's out of tune with reality. It's giving the world a quality that it doesn't really possess. So because of that wrongness, that mistaken view, then naturally it's the result's going to be painful. It's like putting the shoes on the wrong feet. It's going to be painful. It's not that shoe doesn't belong on that foot. Ouch. the world isn't that way. Ouch. You know, the world is not permanent. It's not solid. It's not something that's absolutely external. That's a wrong perception. Therefore, if the mind holds to that wrong, that incorrect perception, the result is going to be painful. So he also says that when we use the word world, loka, in another teaching he says, what is the world? The eye is the world, visual forms are the world. The ear is the world, hearing, sounds are the world, smell, taste, touch, thoughts, feelings, moods. This is the world. The world is the world of our experience. So in Buddhist psychology, when we talk about the world, it doesn't just mean some external idea of the world, like the planet or the stars, the sun and the moon, and the physical universe. But the Buddha brings it much closer to home. He says that the world is the world as you experience it. Whether it's close, whether it's seeing your hand in front of your face, or is it seeing the Andromeda galaxy up in the sky, that's seeing. The world is hearing, thinking, remembering, smelling, tasting, touching. That's the world that we can talk about is the world that is known through our senses. We can't meaningfully talk about any other world in terms of the Buddha's point of view. So when he says that there is the world within this fathom-long body with its perceptions and thoughts, there is the world. It arises. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching is the source of our picture of the world. It arises. it's born here. It takes its shape here. It dissolves here. It comes to its ending and dissolves. We from moment to moment, can observe hearing, sound arising and ceasing, sight, forms, visual colors, shapes arising and ceasing, ideas in the mind, memories arising and ceasing, moods that we like, moods that we dislike, moods that are pleasant, moods that are painful. We can notice them arising and ceasing. The world within this fathom-long body, this very life, with its perceptions and ideas, right here, this is the world, arising and ceasing. So whether we say it's the internal world of my memories, my thoughts, remembering being on the London Underground, going to Lambeth Palace, and meeting the various people from the Buddhist and Christian representatives at this little meeting. As a memory arises and ceases. The pictures in the mind of this temple, seeing the oak pillars and the people sitting on the floor, the colors of the stone paving slabs, the tones of the paint on the walls, the bricks, the lights, the angles and forms of the beams. This is all visual consciousness. Close my eyes, it disappears. The temple has got no physical form. I open my eyes, the physical form of the temple becomes apparent once again. Vision changes, begins, ends. We blink our eyes, the visual world vanishes and then reappears. I say words, between the words there is silence. Sound arises, passes away. So, when we look and explore, we recognize the world is continually arising and passing away in the mind, and that when we know that, when there is a recognition of, oh, there is actually nobody coming and going, there's no things beginning, there's no person coming here or going there, there is just conditions of mind changing. Sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, thought, feeling, memory, ideas, moods. they arise, they cease. So in training the mind in meditation, developing the quality of awareness, wisdom, then what we're doing is we're training the heart to abide in that quality of knowing, and being that awakened, aware, attentive quality, so that the heart, in a sense, stays at home, abides in the quality of knowing, embodies the quality of knowing, and lets go of identification with sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. You know, those of us who've practiced vipassana, insight meditation, who've heard instructions over and over again, then we hear these words, you know, just observe thought and feeling arising and passing away without pushing it away, without grasping hold, without identifying. So rather than I'm thinking, thought arises, passes away. I'm feeling, feeling arises, passes away. I'm hearing, there's a sound outside. A sound arises and passes away. A memory arises, passes away. So we recognize that the designations inside or outside are kind of beside the point. Doesn't really make much of a difference whether we say the sound of a thought, or, you know, the sound of somebody speaking, you know, the sound of a bird or a car or a plane. It's all known in the same place. So vipassana meditation is training that skill, is essentially training the heart in the skills of citta viveka to be that very knowing quality, to abide with that, and to not identify, to learn to not grasp or to take as self or other the patterns of perception and feeling as they come and go, and the result of that, when the heart is trained to not grasp and not to believe in and take refuge in thoughts of self and other, attitudes of here and there, inside and outside, there's a great peacefulness, there's a great clarity and ease. So the perception of sitting in the temple, listening to a Dhamma talk, can arise and pass. Sitting on the underground can arise and pass. Sitting in your room, your kuti, all by yourself, can arise and pass. Feelings of comfort can arise and pass. Feelings of discomfort can arise and pass. Feelings of fear and pain can arise and pass. Feelings of delight and joy can arise and pass. There's a great spaciousness, a great ease, a quality of boundlessness, a sense of the heart completely free and open, limitless. Yeah, that can contain anything, just like a vast mirror that happily reflects anything that appears within it, whether it's red or yellow or blue or green or purple, black or white, whether it's moving or still, small or large, regardless of whether in human terms it would be attractive or unattractive, sacred or profane, the mirror just reflects, not getting excited over the beautiful or the colorful, not getting upset or irritated by the ugly or the rude or the profane, just reflects without bias, without confusion, easily, openly, without any stress, without any bias or being making any choice, completely easeful and endlessly patient, happy to reflect whatever appears within it. So citta viveka, this internal seclusion, is a great power, a great potential that we have. But also it's not something to grasp. When we, in a sense, it's a kind of seclusion, but there still can be a sense of self woven into that. So if kaya viveka, physical seclusion, it's like me in the middle of a lot of stuff, but I'm not bothered by it. So you could. This is also called. It's comparable to the Buddha's teachings about equanimity, about upeka. The Buddha said there's three different kinds of upeka. So the first kind is equanimity or upeka that's based on diversity. So that's like there's a lot of stuff going on, but there's a quality of stillness in the middle of it. So in the same way, kaya viveka is. There's a lot of stuff going on. The world is very busy. It's whirling around, but we're on retreat. So I have my retreat so that the world can be busy and do its thing. But I'm sustaining this little still sanctuary, this still spot in the midst of it. Citta viveka is comparable to what the Buddha called equanimity that's based on unity. So there is. Essentially, all of the sense world is simplified into, well, whatever it is, it's all just arising and passing. It's all anicca, dukkha, anatta. It's all impermanent, unsatisfactory, not self. So that whatever the sense world, the mental world, inner or outer, is doing, it all has this one quality. It all has this one single unifying nature. It arises and passes. It's the same, it's the one pattern for absolutely everything. So all of the sense world, you can say, is unified. So it's like an equanimity based on unity. There's a knower here and the known, but the known is unified and is completely simple. There's just knowing that. But there's still a knower and a known. There's still, a witness and a witnessed, a watcher and a watched. So that citta viveka, it can still, in certain ways, be feeding the sense of I and me. There's me who's watching the world, me watching my mind, me being the still, me being at the still center of things. So even though there's a wholesome and beautiful quality in that, it still can be feeding a stress or a tension. There's still a kind of incompleteness there. So the third level of viveka, which talking with Lumpo Sumedho in the last year or two, he said has been the focus of his attention the last couple of years, is what is called upadhi viveka. Upadhi is one of those Pali words you can't really translate into English. There isn't a good English, rendering of it. But upadhi is what is translated as is sometimes the essentials of existence or the substratum of being. So it's a You can't really narrow it down to less words than that, but it's that, if you like, that very root attachment to identity. It's like the sort of core grasping of the heart at being. And if you like, defined being is if you want to narrow it down to a little bit of a tighter definition, is like the love of defined being something, is that upadhi. So the substratum of existence, upadhi viveka. So upadhi viveka is seclusion or letting go of that root grasping. So upadhi viveka is, say, even letting go of that sense of there being a watcher or an observer, a witness, but rather than me knowing the mind or me watching the mind or me knowing the world. That whole quality of subject and object, the sense of a watcher or some practice that is being done is let go of. So there is, you can say, there is knowing. There's a quality of wisdom, but it's not It's not being a turned into an I or a me, someone who's doing some practice or some person who is getting somewhere with their meditation or doing something. There's hearing, seeing, knowing. It's a profound level of practice, but it also I feel it's very beautiful and helpful, very interesting how the Buddha spoke of this also as a viveka, as a seclusion, a retreat from the subject-object duality, me here, the world out there, me who's practicing, me who's developing the path, me who developing wisdom or being liberated. The whole I, me and mine delusion is being let go of. So there is the quality of profound freedom, and there's no person who's being free, no I who is being liberated, but it's simply the mind knowing its own nature, Dhamma, aware of its own quality, its own nature, and that's the most profound freedom within that can be realized. So this is what the Buddha called the third kind of equanimity, is the equanimity, the upeka, that's based on non-identification, on what in Pali is called atamayata, where the mind is not creating any kind of this or that, no here and there, no this time and that time, no past, no future, no knower and no known. There's a letting go of this and that. And as in another teaching, the Buddha said, when the mind is truly awake, then and you in the seeing, there's only the seen; in the hearing, there's only the heard; in the cognizing, there's only the cognizing, then you won't be able to find yourself in the world of this or in the world of that or anywhere between the two. So this is, a very subtle or very profound level of Dhamma practice. But if we really want to retreat, we say, tomorrow evening we officially have our group retreat time, and if we really want to develop retreat, if we really want a retreat, then the Kaya Viveka is only the first stage, but I deeply encourage an exploration of these other layers of retreating. So retreating both, not just at the level of physical seclusion, like a group meditation practice, but to use these times of group retreat to also to develop these layers of citta viveka, the internal seclusion, so there can be that sense of watching and being ready to know and to receive and to be at home with a great variety of perceptions, like and dislike, pleasure and pain, gain and loss, comfort and discomfort as they arise and pass, to find that inner spaciousness and that quality of citta viveka, but even beyond that to see if you can use the retreat time that we have to specifically and particularly explore upadhi viveka. And maybe listening to these words, maybe you've heard this subject spoken about before, and maybe this is completely new, or maybe before you couldn't figure it out and it didn't mean much to you, and hearing it again this evening, you still can't figure it out and it still doesn't mean much. But I would suggest this is a really important, useful area to explore. We might say to ourselves, "Oh, I love retreat," but it's not so much the retreat itself in terms of the routine that we love, but I would suggest it's more we love the place that the retreat takes us to. That when those moments of real upadhi viveka, when there's a letting go of self and other, a letting go of past and future, when the heart is truly free of time and place and self, that's what we really like. When people ask about the eight precepts and say, how can you give up music? Music is really beautiful. Music is so sacred. What about Bach? How could you think of that as a defilement? Or how could you give up music? And that's often in the West, the one aspect of the eight precepts that people want to negotiate most vigorously. It's the seemingly what people fix on, one of the sense areas that people seem most unhappy to give up. But so I've reflected on this often in the past, and what came to me was that we don't really like the music. It's not Bach, or whether it's Johann Sebastian Bach or the Velvet Underground the latest brand of pop music or hip hop or whatever it might be that we're into. It's not the music that we love, it's the place the music takes us to. That's what we love. It's where the heart goes, or what we feel in the heart when there is a sense of being fully carried by the music, being lost in the music, being carried away by the music. And if you pay attention, you see that there's a quality of energy in the music. There's harmony. There is a quality of presence. You can't really hang on to it. There's a timelessness, there's a presence, there's an energy, there's an integration, a harmony. And it's like through the absorbing and receiving of that physical sound, that sense quality, it takes the mind to a particular set of attributes. And we love, that's what we love, this exploring it for myself. And sometimes if you have a favorite piece of music and then you play it and then it doesn't really have that effect, you feel there's a sense of disappointment. Oh, it's not really working. There's something wrong with it. I need to adjust the machine, or I'm not really in the mood. I can't really appreciate it. And that's telling us it's not the sound, it's the mind. And so I feel one of the reasons why people are particularly attached to music, and sacred music in particular, is because they love the place that the music takes them to. That's what we love. And meditation and the qualities of Dhamma practice, they work by taking the mind to that same place that sacred music takes the mind to, that there's energy, presence, harmony, integration, and a loss of self, that you're lost in the music, as in that the sense of self has fallen away, that the heart is absorbed, awakened to the ground of its own being. And there's no words to describe that. And as soon as the words come in and say, oh, this is magnificent, or who's the conductor, or oh, this is great, as soon as the words come in, often the words distort that purity of presence. Like in one of W.B. Yeats's poems, he says the mind settles upon the moment like the long-legged fly upon the surface of the water, like a daddy long legs or a crane fly lands on the surface tension of the water, and then boing, it kind of distorts the skin, the surface of the water, and the mind lands on the surface of the moment. Oh, this is great! And in that very grabbing, It's burst the bubble. It's that perfect quality is lost. So what we're doing with meditation, and the development of insight, the development, the deepening of these qualities of viveka, is to be able to find that quality, that pure presence of mind, the Dhamma aware of its own nature, here and now. That's what the heart loves. That's what it most enjoys. And we in the times of retreat, it's not the retreat that we like. It's not the retreat that is really blessed. It's that place that can be that quality that can be awakened to, that the retreat environment helps to provide. But if we make the mistake of it's the retreat that then we're grasping the wrong thing. We're thinking like it's the notes of the music. It's the sound that's the thing. It's not the sound that's the thing in the music. It's the mind. Similarly, it's not the retreat routine in a retreat. It's the mind. And the more fully and completely we can recognize that, then we use the retreat environment, the kaya viveka, that becomes a powerful and much beloved, useful tool. But we're not grasping that as what is the thing that's really of value. That which is really of value is your mind here and now. That's where the great treasure lies. It's in the mind. It's not in the routine. It's not in the sound of a piece of music. It's the mind that is the great treasure. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening.